Welcome to Mastering Sustainability. I'm Madeline Armstrong, Sustainable Partnerships Manager at Okeanos. I have a master's degree in sustainable business, but as the industry evolves, I'm realizing there's still so much I've yet to master. Each episode, I'll be joined by Ray Laughlin, our Degradation Innovation Director, who brings years of experience in the science of sustainability. However, despite his extensive knowledge, he feels like he still has so much to master in the ever-evolving language of ESG, from carbon reporting to understanding the alphabet soup of the acronyms at the UN, there's still so much to learn. If you have concepts you still have yet to master, stick around and we're going to tackle them together with the help of industry experts, academics, and friends alike.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Mastering Sustainability. Maddie, we've got a really good show in store for our listeners today. We have Dr. Townsend joining us to talk about it.
Yes, we are so excited to have Professor Townsend joining us for our first episode on greenwashing.
In the next segment, listeners, you're going to get to have a crash course on what role marketing plays in sustainability and how greenwashing can be deceiving. I think Dr. Townsend was a great guest to have speak about this, and I'm really excited for you listeners to take a listen.
Today, we're talking to Claudia Townsend, who is an associate professor at the University of Miami in the Herbert Business School. She performs research on consumer behavior and decision-making. Specifically, she looks at how aesthetics and visual presentation of information influences judgment and choice, branding, how people decide to donate, and consumer technology interaction. Her research has been published in the top academic marketing journals and covered by popular press, including the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and the NPR Marketplace. She serves as an associate editor of the Journal of Marketing and the Journal of Marketing Research, and is on the editorial review board of the Journal of Consumer Research. Dr. Townsend received her PhD at UCLA's Anderson School of Management and a Bachelor's of Administration from Brown University. Thank you so much for being here with us on episode one of Mastering Sustainability. Our topic today is greenwashing. Thank you again, Professor Townsend, for being here. It's an extensive background, and one of my favorite parts of this is you were my master's teacher at the University of Miami.
I am delighted to be here. I'm excited to be talking to you guys. I'm excited to have an excuse to see you again, a former student, one of my favorites, and to discuss this great topic.
As a launching point, Dr. Townsend, we would love to hear what led you down the road to reaching this point in your career of being an expert in greenwashing.
So, I mean, there's kind of two steps to that. One is, how did I end up being a marketing professor? And then how did I end up looking at sustainability? The marketing professor thing, I fell into it, to be honest. My undergrad was in economics and psychology, and I saw these as two distinct interests that would never overlap. So I said, oh, let me try economics. And I did economic consulting, and that wasn't a great fit. It was interesting, a little dry. And then I tried market research. And somehow I decided I really wanted to be doing research and I wanted to be in charge of what I'm looking at. And I found this whole idea of studying decision-making and how people make decisions really interesting. So that's what led me to get my PhD in marketing and decide that a career of research and decision-making was the thing for me. So then I came to UM. I've been here for 12 years. And along with teaching, I mostly do research. Many people end up doing work in this field because of personal interest. There isn't a lot of training right now on anything related to business. And so it was something I was interested in. I was exploring on my own. I was reading about. And then University of Miami, the Miami Herbert Business School, we really saw this as something that needed to be in the marketplace, a master's in sustainable business, which is what Maddie, you were in our inaugural class, correct?
I was in our second class.
Second class.
Yes.
So, you know, the idea was, look, this is such an important part of business. Mm-hmm. And again, there's not a lot of training in it. So everyone's learning on the job. Can we create a degree that really helps someone get some foundation? So I immediately jumped at the chance of teaching. My course is called Marketing of Sustainable Products and Services. So I could combine my knowledge I had about teaching and research to create this course. And then that's really motivated me to stay current and stay on top of these topics and continue to explore them. So I do think it's probably true that, and maybe this is true of both of you, that a lot of people end up working in this area because they're passionate about it. It's something that matters. And, you know, you want to be able to do something. So that was the reason for me.
That's absolutely amazing. To be able to create an entire course off of a need that you see in the marketplace for this type of thing. That's, I think, one of the unique things that this podcast is going to bring is opportunities for individuals like yourself to tell your story, because that's such a unique story to find out that someone saw the want of this and made it happen.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to be here to plug.
No, you're fine. No, go plug away, please.
Not the goal of being here, but I think we're starting to see more and more of this in business curricula, and we're starting to see more degrees that discuss sustainability outside of the hard sciences. But it's nice to be on the forefront of it. You know, I can tell you, for example, I haven't found a good textbook yet, which says there's an opportunity there. So, I end up kind of teaching by gathering the materials I think are good, whether it's popular press or whatever.
And one thing about that, too, was I think that was a huge benefit for us. I think as students, as the second class, and even at Okeanos, we have a graduate from the first inaugural class. We got to influence the curriculum and give advice and feedback. And even now in our roles, we find opportunities to connect some of the learnings that we have. We just connected with the director of the program over some carbon credits questions. And he was like, this is a great opportunity for me to plug this into our next round of classes. And so that was something I actually really loved about being in an early program. Because at the time, I think I was researching, besides Europe, in North America, there was about 5 courses, master's degrees, that was really focused on business and not just on the science side. And from a business standpoint and coming into that corporate role, business sustainability has to start with your business being able to be sustained. You're not going to get that environmental, lack of a better word, maybe hippie side of an education from this, but you're getting that realistic, how do we implement sustainable strategies in business while still being profitable? And that's what I really appreciated out of the University of Miami's degree.
Yeah. I mean, and I always say businesses should be thinking about sustainability, not just because the good thing to do, but it's smart business. By definition, a business needs to be sustainable. You want your business around 10, 15, 20 years from now. And if you're not thinking about these things, you're going to have a much harder time being around, being relevant, getting the resources you need, raw materials, things like that. So it's not that we created this program to make the world a better place, although I think that's part of it. It's really like this is something that the business world needs.
Well, let's launch into that then a little bit about the business side of what you're doing. The term greenwashing, it is such a large term that carries a lot under it. The umbrella, when you say greenwashing, can cover everything from just verbiage to marketing materials that are put out there. What is greenwashing? What does that invoke in you? How do you respond to something like that?
Sure. So overall, I think it's when a company, they mislead their consumers in a manner that makes them seem more sustainable than they really are. There's 2 things to think about that. One is, especially right now, it's not always on purpose. There are examples of companies saying, like, let's use this language because it's more convincing, even though that's not fully representing the truth. But as we just discussed, this is a new area. And so a lot of the times it's because people don't know that the messaging is inaccurate. But again, a lot of the times it is, let's position ourselves this way, even if that's not entirely accurate of what the product is. People also talk about greenwashing if they just feel like an organization or company, if they end up spending more time and money on promoting their sustainability than actually on minimizing the environmental impact. Any company, you could argue, that's really spending a lot of money putting that message out there, that in and of itself is a little bit of a form of greenwashing if they're investing more in the messaging than the action. But the more kind of formal definition is that you're misleading consumers to make yourself seem more sustainable than you are.
As a consumer, though, I'm someone who in the past 5 to 10 years has started to really focus in on products and companies that are trying to make that sustainability a goal. How is someone like me, though, going to really understand whether a product is actually eco-friendly or it isn't? And I'm just being told it is instead.
I wish I had a good answer for that. I think that's part of the issue with greenwashing right now. I think the short answer is really the onus is on the consumer to do their research. But what I would say more broadly is claims that are more specific are giving you accurate information. When things are more general, when someone says it's an eco-friendly product, it's a green product, but there's no kind of evidence for that, that's usually a red flag. But it's still the Wild West right now in terms of what can and can't happen. And we can talk a little bit about that and what regulations are there. There increasingly are regulations, but even, for example, we have these third-party verifications where a company can go and have independent third-party say whether their product is free trade or whatever. Even those, there's so many of them now. These labels that you'll see on products, there are literally thousands of them. Even those, yes, they're saying something, but what actually are they verifying is hard to pin down. So unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for you except to say, read the fine print and look for specifics. When they say what percent of the packaging has been recycled, that's evidence. They're giving you evidence. If you can't seem to find any evidence, that may be because there's not much there.
Let's just talk about some of these terms for a second too, because I think it's interesting. There's obviously, as you said, thousands of them out there, probably sustainability first, or this product is sustainable or eco-friendly. What are some of the main words that come to mind that consumers could look out to that are typically overly greenwashed?
Sure. So eco-friendly, green, natural, non-toxic, sustainable. FTC has called out green and eco-friendly specifically. They're saying to say it's eco-friendly, you really need to have what they say is a clear, prominent, and specific environmental benefit. So that's what I encourage consumers to look for when I say look for evidence, clear, prominent, and specific environmental benefit. When someone says they're sustainable, they're not doing that. So that's kind of something to think about.
And if you're trying to market your sustainable product, let's say you truly have a sustainable product and you want to advertise those features, but without using these over greenwashed terms, is there any advice you would have on how to communicate that message? Because oftentimes you're communicating that within 3 to 4 words. You're not writing sentences on your packaging. So how do you get that information out to your consumers?
I think that's a great point because, you know, you have limited space, whether it's an ad or a package. You know, you can't do a whole paragraph on what you are or are not doing. When you're the brand, be specific about what you're doing, right? Saying eco-friendly doesn't actually offer any information. Saying this product is recyclable or, you know, we've used this much ocean plastic, that is a fact that people can look at and evaluate for themselves. I think the other thing to tell companies to think about is there's so many different aspects of creating a product or a service. And so we always say, think about it from cradle to grave, which is to say, yes, maybe it's recyclable, but just at least acknowledge or think about the whole process. Where did your materials come from? How did they get to you? How are the workers treated? What's going to happen to it at the end of its life cycle? So really thinking about the full life cycle of your product, your packaging, everything will enable you to think more holistically about where improvements can be made.
Ray, I kind of want to tie you and ask you a question about this because you, the ASTM standards, those are scientific backed research that come with a label. And although consumers aren't maybe as technical to know what ASTMs are, do we need to get to a point where there's a degree of science or that type of labeling on packaging? From your perspective, do you think standards like that should be on packaging when we say biodegradable, for example?
Yes and no. Again, 15 years in the industry has made me extremely jaded. I have seen a number of different companies completely misrepresent what ASTM standards are telling you when they do the test, which then leaves a consumer with the onus to go look up a standard to start trying to understand what is this standard actually testing? When in reality, I've run into constantly companies that'll claim biodegradability in traditional landfills. There is no biodegradable traditional landfill standard. There are anaerobic biodegradation standards, and anaerobic biodegradation does happen in a landfill, But there's no standard to correlate those two things together because trying to standardize a traditional landfill is impossible. There is no one set rule set that a traditional landfill will follow. So what you find is people will quote these standards and then not be able to back up that claim with hard evidence of what they're trying to say. But they have to be questioned about that by a consumer who has to understand that the standard they're claiming isn't what it says. And that's a slippery slope in some ways, going into what you were saying earlier, the regulations, especially end of life. A lot of the sustainable and greenwashing terminology comes from the end of life scenarios that we're talking about. Recyclability, biodegradability, compostability. These are, again, weighty terms that carry a lot underneath them when in reality, not everything fits neatly into the puzzle piece of how this works. So if you could speak a little bit about the greenwashing in terms of the end of life scenarios that you've seen come through in the marketplace and how that's being used.
Yeah, sure. I think echoing what I said earlier, which is unfortunately right now, the onus is really on the consumer to do their research. So, you know, the FTC is trying, right? In 1992, they created the Green Guides with step one of let's put some regulation around what people can and can't say. And that's constantly being updated, but we're not there yet. I think what I like to point to as where I'd like to see things go, and I, like you, do feel jaded and it's hard to see how we're going to get out of this. But
welcome
then,
to the club. It's yeah, a great club
the
to
one
be a
thing
part
I
of.
Do want to say is I think the example to us is if you think about nutrition labels. So those are actually not that old. The nutrition facts that you see on every food product sold in the US, that was standardized in 1994, right? So before that, it was very similar that kind of anyone could say anything. There was no definitions. And that's now been standardized where you have to report certain things. And more than anything, because it's standardized, consumers know how to look at that and they know how to read it and understand it. So I think we're not there yet. But to me, that's a guide of where we could go. And so you're talking about end of life. If there was a standard way of reporting, you know, what percent would go in each of various locations, consumers would probably, especially those who are interested, kind of very quickly learn how to read that label if it's standardized and everyone sees it.
As an interesting side note, I have consulted with multiple government agencies, regulatory bodies of different entities around the world on sustainability, biodegradability, specifically for different products. I actually have envisioned something similar to what you were talking about. There's the nutritional facts on any food type label. I think packaging is one day potentially going to head to the point where you have a sustainability facts portion that has to be dedicated to the package. Because one of the biggest problems right now is buying that ad space on a package. Every centimeter of a box is covered
matters.
And to try and put more than just green can be challenging because a company doesn't want to give up their logo space. They want to advertise their brand. But now, if eventually it gets to the point where I think consumer or the government is going to regulate packaging so that they have to have some form of end of life scenario or sustainability scenario box that has to be prominent on the package. I foresee that happening one day in the far future.
Right. How do we verify those claims that go onto that nutrition label, for lack of a better word, of sustainability? When we talk about composting, for example, as a great way of an end of life, this has been the new way of packaging that's been labeled green over plastic. You want your plastic packaging to be compostable. But the reality of it is in Miami, for example, where Dr. Townsend and I are, we don't have composting facilities. We don't have industrial composting facilities. And lots of people live in apartments where you don't have a lawn to do even home composting. But then let's go back further. That packaging isn't home compostable either. It's only industrial compostable suited. And so when you walk into a Whole Foods and you see tons of forks and plastic saying this is compostable, that's just going to the landfill. And as you know, Ray, if anything is a bioorganic source that goes to a landfill and is cut off from oxygen, it's likely to produce methane over CO2, which means it's 80 to 500 times worse than it was if it was maybe traditional plastic. So there's lots of scenarios that we need to consider to help educate the consumer of those pathways, because those end of life scenarios are so greenwashed as an industry to begin with. You know, when we talk about recycling, 9% of plastic is recycled, and a good portion of that is just PET, leaving remaining parts of the other 7 resin codes very minimally recycled. And so there's a problem there too. And we could talk about that with biodegradability as well, but it's all 3 pathways are greenwashed, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something. And if you just look deep into any one of these issues, recycling, you know, it's hard to recycle well. It's confusing. It varies state to state, city to city, what you can and can't recycle. You can't blame consumers for being really confused. But the result is, right, we get everything mixed together, and that's not good for anyone. So, yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, I think some sort of standardization in terms of how you label it, how you educate consumers, and ideally what resources are available for disposal, that'll help as well.
This has been a fascinating conversation. There is one question that's pressing on my mind this entire time,
and yeah.
I'm hoping that I don't get you in any trouble by asking this.
Yeah.
But who's doing greenwashing poorly, and who's out there messaging sustainability properly, in your opinion, so that people who are listening can look at a model and say, okay, from a doctorate's point of view, this is good and this is not so good?
I think it's a hard question to answer. The more niche brands, the ones that are not well known, tend to be the ones who are thinking more critically about this and putting themselves out well.
Sure.
At the same time, I mean, I will say some of the really big players are leading the way in this. And I think what's interesting is some of the bigger players, they're not talking about it. I think there's probably 2 reasons for that. One is from a marketing perspective, it's probably not relevant to their target audience. So like we've all said, you have limited package space, you have limited ad time. So you may be doing this because you know you need to, but if your customer doesn't care yet about sustainability, you're not going to waste your packaging. Also, companies are increasingly aware that once you make one claim and once you start to say you're sustainable on one factor, then unfortunately, you start to get kind of more eyes on you. And then people will say, well, but what about this? And what about this? So I think it points to this idea of you just need to be specific. You can say our product is made from 30% ocean plastic, and you're not misleading anyone. And you're just saying, look, we're trying to address this problem, and I'm not saying anything about anything else. In some ways, I think it's the companies that are doing a lot and not talking about it that I think are in some ways doing the best, right? I think we've also seen some big companies really misstep.
All right, everyone, that's the sound of the bell.
That was a crash course in greenwashing if I've ever heard one. We want to take a moment and make sure we mention that this show is sponsored by Okeanos, creators of Made from Stone technology, which enables companies to reduce their CO2 footprint and overall plastic use in packaging and everyday items. You got a few seconds, listeners, before the second half of this show where we start our master's course on greenwashing with Dr. Townsend. In this section, you're going to hear all about cultural capital and how sustainability has changed that terminology for the better or worse, the dangers of greenwashing, and how you can be active in the field. Take a listen.
We can dive back into this. Let's talk about the FTC Green Guides. Over in Europe, they have a similar system in place that's actually enacted into law. Here in the US, I know the FTC Green Guides are trying to be implemented into law, not just a suggestion for companies. How do you see companies reacting to this?
Yeah, 2 things. I mean, one I want to point out, which you've kind of alluded to, is Europe is so far ahead of us with all of this. So I think when thinking about where are we going, I think we can look to Europe and say, well, that's where the US will be in 5-10 years, if not longer. And we can look to them as they really are leading the way. Things like labeling for gas and nuclear projects, which they now have laws about what you can and can't say. And then on the flip side of how are companies responding to the green guides, I think some find it as a useful tool and some find it as something that's preventing them from getting their business done. We do see the FTC suing companies, right? So that is likely. But what's more likely is consumers are savvy, and it's the consumer who's going to react badly. I teach in all my courses that you should assume that everything you're doing will be on the front page of a newspaper, right? And are you okay with that? let's not talk about what's the right thing to do. Let's talk about what's the right business decision. That is not sustainable business. Sustainable meaning you want to keep profits and stay in business. If you're misrepresenting things, then it means that the consumer is buying your product is not actually satisfied with it, right? Or the consumer buying it isn't actually the person that product is for. Maybe there's a consumer who wants your products, but the consumer right now who's buying it is one who's interested in a green product, and that's not necessarily what your product is. So not everyone has to be green. I mean, ideally, yes, but on the market side of things, there are consumers who aren't looking for that. And so if you represent your product well, you will have satisfied customers. If you misrepresent your product, you will not have satisfied customers.
And that's interesting to me. It brings us back to the beginning point that you said that I really like, is that lots of professionals that are at the top of companies leading their sustainability teams or their marketing around the subjects are professionals that came into this role. They didn't have education specifically on sustainability. So, Professor Townsend, what role do you see education playing in this new wave of industry professionals that you're inspiring and teaching?
Yeah, great. I think, first of all, making sustainability and sustainable business a mainstream topic, saying that this is business, this isn't some niche, but this is how you do business in 2023 and going forward, I think that really helps. I think businesses more and more are seeing that and going in that path. But once you have it part of curriculum, once you have professors talking about it, it now is a mainstream thing. It's not just some niche thing that, again, tree huggers are thinking about or tree hugger companies are thinking about. So I think that's really important. I think it's something we're all learning as we go along. And it's, which this is good news, it's something that's changing really quickly. State of the art understanding or understanding of kind of what we need to do to help, that's changing so quickly. So keeping people up to date on that, I think, is also important.
In the marketplace, do you see it being more of the consumer or the brands right now driving this push to have sustainable products?
The marketplace is responding to the consumer. I think that's actually one point I want to make, which is one thing I think people in this space kind of take for granted, which is something we have going for us, is being green is actually a positive quality. It sounds kind of intuitive, but if you look 20, 30 years ago, buying sustainable products wasn't necessarily something someone was proud of. It was hippie, it was feminine, it was very much associated with women. So men were not about to say, I'm interested in this. And it was not something aspirational. And now that we see green as something aspirational, that someone wants to show off that they have an electric car, as people in the green space, that's incredible. That's that you have an attribute that is, again, aspirational, something that gives you what we call in our world cultural capital, like makes you seem good to others, is really a value. The outcome then is greenwashing, right? Because everyone wants to be that thing, even if they're not. But I think that is something not to take for granted, because it's only recently that we've come to that place that someone wants to say, no, 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 I didn't buy that. I bought this because it's green. Part of that probably in part results from the fact that, yes, green products tend to be more expensive. But again, in some ways, it means there's less access, but it does then mean that these products kind of carry this cultural capital, which makes it something consumers want.
That's an interesting one. I'd love for you to expand on cultural capital, because this is the first time I've actually heard of this.
Oh,
I can see, I think, where the terminology is coming from and where it's going. But yeah, I would love to hear an explanation from you on the gaining or loss of cultural capital, especially when it comes to sustainability.
Sure. So, I mean, it's something we talk about in the world of psychology, consumer behavior. Cultural capital is really anything you have that has value in society. Okay. So we tend to think about it as money, intelligence, education, these kind of things, that things you would brag about, right?
I don't have any of, but go on, please.
I highly doubt that. To break down the word, it's things that, you know, culture sees as having value, right? And so what I'm saying is sustainability, whether it's the company and the product or a person and their actions, right now we've come to a point where that is something aspirational, something to brag about, is something that's working for us.
That's really good. I love that idea. I love that I'm in a deficit of cultural capital, but that's all right. I'll change that eventually one day.
I think right now, hosting a podcast, that's got a lot of cultural capital.
Oh.
Podcast host, that you can call yourself a podcast host, you've got it.
What role do you see life cycle analysis taking part in the marketplace? As understand, like, when I present on our technology at Okeanos, I mention life cycle analysis pretty much every time. And I get a blank stare 50% of the time, and the other 50% people start to understand what I'm talking about. Are you seeing that becoming a hot topic?
Yes. And I agree with you that it's not something people are thinking about yet, but it's a pretty intuitive conversation, right? I think it's almost step one in, like, how do you start to think about sustainability, especially if you've got a tangible, if you're talking about services, less so. But if you're selling a tangible good, life cycle analysis is step one of acknowledging the impact the entire way. That's where we need to at least have people having that conversation.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of power in the life cycle analysis in marketing. I think one of the famous marketing campaigns that first maybe used that is the Dawn dishwashing, running your dishwasher over or washing your dishes by hand. A lot of older generations would say it's more sustainable. You're going to save water if you wash your dishes by hand because you can control the water. But realistically, after they did that whole life cycle analysis, and can now advertise as that, no, if you run your dishwasher once a night, you're saving more water than hand washing.
You just summarized probably a 10-year argument I've been having with my wife. And she finally hit me with the scientific study. Yeah. And
so she
said,
was,
no.
She was team dishwasher.
She was team dishwasher, okay. And I was team wash by hand. Uh-huh. And she hit me with the study and said, you can't argue with me anymore. And I said, you're right. I got to start using the dishwasher more. Absolutely.
There you go. Just ask Maddie.
You know what? I'm the go-to person in the company that he asks for these life cycle analyses.
That's true. So it actually is true.
I am the one producing these. On top of this, though, right? And I think this kind of segues back into what we talked about before about the labeling and the potential nutrition labels. We saw a great example from Allbirds and Adidas do the labeling on the shoe, on the tongue, where they were able to hide it, but you were able to see the actual environmental impacts of that shoe in different sections.
All right, well,
so you can see the carbon.
I'm the one here that doesn't understand or did any prep work. Can you tell me about this? Because I don't know about this effort by Adidas.
Of course, it's a shoe that they teamed
got
up
that
with
part.
Allbirds,
go on.
Which is a sustainable shoe company, or that's how they advertise themselves. And what they did on the inside of the tongue of their shoe, they put a label where you would normally see your foot size. They broke down the environmental impacts they had on each environmental topic that they deemed important to their consumers. So I think CO2 was on there, how much CO2 went into that shoe or how much was released from making that shoe. Water was an impact category. They might have had land use. They had 3 or 4 different facts there that essentially made up a nutrition label or what you would look to. And life cycle analysis would be the way you would back that up to avoid greenwashing.
That leads me to a question then about, you know, Maddie and my's job revolves around CO2 footprints, and we talk about it on the daily. What is your read on society and consumers as a whole understanding CO2 footprints? And do you think that's going to continue being or eventually be a topic that everybody starts to assess products by?
Yeah, I mean, look, people who are in the know love it because it's one way to encompass so many different aspects of a product. I don't think the average consumer is there yet, right? I don't even think, for better or worse, by the way, they understand when someone says a carbon offset, what am I offsetting or not offsetting, as we might later discuss, but what does that even mean? So I don't think we're there yet. It's not tangible. It's not something like recycling that's in the consumer lexicon.
Gotcha. When it comes to net zero, what does that mean? Because I see and hear that all the time. Am I actually being deceived, or is someone telling me something good that I just don't understand?
I mean, I would say in most cases, you are being deceived. You know, we can talk about carbon offsets. by definition, carbon offsets are essentially misleading because people don't really understand what you mean by offset, right? What we're just saying is we're compensating for what we're doing in this arena by doing something else in another arena. I mean, I don't have to tell you guys this or probably even your listeners, but oftentimes those offsets were things that were already going to happen anyways.
Could you define what a carbon offset actually is then when someone says, oh, these are carbon offsets? What are we offsetting, say?
So yeah, basically the way it is a company identifies how much carbon they're emitting, right? Mm-hmm. And then they say essentially to compensate for that or offset that, we're going to invest. Usually they're just investing. They're not actually doing the action, although they may be in some cases. We're going to actually go to a broker. There are brokers for these things or a trading platform. And we're going to spend money to give to another organization or country who is doing something that would offset the amount of carbon we're creating. So the idea is, okay, we may be creating greenhouse gases here, but these trees over here are at the same time, you know, getting rid of that much.
Gotcha.
I'm guessing your audience understands this, but kind of the two things that are wrong with this is the calculation is off in that when a company makes a product, they know very specifically the carbon that's created. But then when you go into the idea of the offset, it may be that you're planting a tree today, which is great. But the idea is, okay, well, actually, in 20 years, this tree may be able to offset that amount of carbon, but it's not doing that today. And we don't know what's going to happen to you now and 20 years from now. So yes, it's better than nothing. But in some ways, it's giving companies a way to kind of say, okay, we don't need to actually look at how to reduce our carbon emissions. We're just going to offset. And consumers as well, right? It's like, okay, I can fly on my private jet across the country because I'm going to then buy these carbon offsets. And to be fair, I'm not blaming anyone. It's an issue of education. At this point, we don't have a better system. It's not regulated enough that we can say specifically, no, this is a one-for-one comparison.
So net zero then is the marketing speak for selling star names to people, more or less, is what I'm hearing.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, most of it is based on carbon offsetting, saying we're carbon neutral. Very few companies who are talking about carbon neutral or have a goal of being carbon neutral are being carbon neutral because they aren't creating carbon. Mm-hmm. No, it's because they are offsetting the amount that they're creating. And offsetting should be in quotes.
And while we're on this topic of carbon neutral, you see companies saying they're carbon negative, which means they are 100% buying carbon offsets. There's no other way, correct me if I'm wrong, to getting to that stance. So when we see the words carbon negative, what immediately goes through your mind?
You know, we've created an industry, which again, like it is better than nothing. There's a much bigger conversation about inequality across countries. It's become a marketplace where you have some countries that create carbon and then they pay other countries to essentially do nothing. The inequality is growing.
It seems like a complicated subject, too, to go into carbon offsets. Like, Maddie, I'm pretty sure you've worked on our carbon offset program here at Okeanos, haven't you?
I have. And it brings up a lot of interesting questions because what it does do by creating carbon offsets that can then turn to credits is you're providing a revenue stream that can go back into the innovation for further producing either low carbon materials or innovation or things that could help close that inequality gap, depending on where that revenue is actually going to and if it's legitimized, et cetera. And we see that as a big problem at the last COP27 in Egypt there and the one before that in Copenhagen, where they were discussing how do we regulate carbon markets. But again, this is kind of a point that's been lost there, too, is talking about how do we secure the inequality gap in the carbon market industry.
It's better than nothing on the one hand, but I think you've made the point that ideally those companies, rather than investing in carbon offsets, could take that money and look inwards and say, okay, how do we lower the emissions we're making in the first place? That's much harder, much more expensive, rather than just taking some money and put it on the carbon market. So in some ways, providing an easy solution isn't the ideal.
I agree. And I think this really needs to be addressed as we go further down this path of carbon offsets, how we regulate those and who regulates them. How do you as a company prove that you've done as much reductions in your own scope one or two emissions before you look outwards to reducing those through a different company or buying those carbon offsets?
Yes.
Are we heading to a point where it's going to be compulsory, that regulatory bodies are going to say, if you're doing business in my territory, my country, you need to offset your carbons by X amount? Or do you still think it's just going to stay as a voluntary program for now?
I think that is one place that we're going to start seeing regulation. Carbon trading is becoming a bigger thing. It is already happening on a grander scale between countries. Will it happen? Probably. Yes, I think so.
Okay, good. Can you talk a little bit about where your focus has been in this ever-evolving sustainability marketplace and the trends that you may be seeing?
Sure. I have a bunch of different research projects. One thing I'm currently looking at is the rental market. So increasingly, one way is to promote a more sustainable behavior and actually really gaining a lot of traction in younger audiences, maybe your listener, is this idea of you don't need to own everything. You can just rent it, right? Whether it's clothing, a car, a tool. And so it's a much more sustainable business model, or world model, should we say. There's tons and tons of research on how people decide to buy and what people buy. But really, people haven't really looked at the rental decision. So companies who sell products and now are starting to think about, okay, could we rent instead of sell? They're applying what they know about buying to renting. So I have some research looking at how when someone's deciding to rent, it's actually a different decision. And what we find is when you're thinking about buying, it's a lot about the product. What are the attributes of the product? Probably the one that's most prevalent these days is clothing. There's a pretty mainstream population right now, especially for special occasions, where people will now rent clothing. Men have been renting tuxedos for a long time, but now women are getting into it with dresses. People rent for business meetings, things like that. So the idea is when you're going shopping to buy something, you're thinking about that clothing. I want it to look a certain way. When you're thinking about renting, you're thinking actually a lot more about usage. Because you're thinking about how you're going to use it, when you're going to use it, it actually changes what products you end up choosing. You, at the end of the day, end up choosing what's kind of a more optimal product for you. In a weird way, you're more satisfied with it. Because by thinking about the usage, you're much more aware of kind of what features you'll use and not use. But it's the beginning of us starting to understand, if people are going to rent, what do we need to know about their consumer behavior? What are they thinking about? And how do we understand that better to ensure that people are satisfied in the rental market and stay in it?
So essentially, it's a circular economy, but for retail.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you can help businesses understand this market, we're going to grow it. And consumers aren't going to have whether a shed full of tools that they use once a year or a closet full of clothing that they only use once a year, make the economy more circular by understanding why and when people rent and make that not just more accessible, but something more appealing.
That's pretty fascinating, especially when you find sustainable opportunities in regions of the market that no one would have considered. You know?
Yeah. I mean, what I like about it is I think there's a lot of people in that marketplace who aren't doing it for sustainability reasons. And so to me, that's kind of the best when you're tapping into a market, then it's got broader appeal, right? If you can get the general market to buy into your product that just so happens to be a more sustainable option, then you know, that's great. It's not a green consumer who's going out and renting a power tool. It's someone who's saying, I don't have a lot of space. Or maybe it's someone who's frugal and says, I'd rather spend less.
That's great.
Graduation gowns. As a university professor, I have now two. What do we do with those after you wear them for an hour? But why aren't those rented? Why aren't we seeing more industries go towards this? Or what can a consumer do when you're faced with that option of, I have to buy this thing that I know I'm only going to use once? What do you do with it after? Or how do consumers push change?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that that's another market we see opening up is like the consumer to consumer market, right? You reselling it is the next step, right? You know, I'm sure you guys
hold on to it for 10 years and then it becomes the perfect dress costume for your kid if you ever have one.
Harry Potter Halloween costume.
Exactly.
Repurposed. Not the worst idea.
Upcycling.
Upcycling, exactly. Upcycling. I should tell you, at the PhD level, the gowns are so expensive that no one buys them. So you get this fancy hood for the university you got your PhD from. And then there is a matching robe. But again, they're like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. It's absurd. Actually, there is a rental market. So anytime I'm in graduation, UM rents, because I got my PhD at UCLA, the UCLA gown for me. So maybe that's the answer. Make it super expensive and then the rental market will appear. Yeah. I do think there's so many marketplaces for secondhand goods that could become third-hand goods and go on and on. Not only do I participate in the market, but I'm sure you guys are members of these like buy nothing groups. I find that the amount of stuff that I now don't throw out, that I can find someone actually wanted that thing, is great.
Yeah. A good way to relate this back to greenwashing and greenwashing by association. We're starting to see asset managers of putting out green portfolios, giving consumers that option to buy into more sustainable investments. But the greenwashing that's coming with this is increasingly more dangerous. How do we keep everyone honest in this field?
Right. Well, I think we haven't talked about, which is pretty obvious, but why is greenwashing dangerous? It sounds silly, but I want to address that because I think it's secondary negative effects that maybe not everyone's aware of, right? So obviously, we're all aware of the fact that someone who has the best intentions is investing their money in somewhere that doesn't actually meet the goal that they want, right? So someone is buying something that's less green or investing in something that's less sustainable than what they want. So that's the most obvious negative. But I think there's some others that I just want to highlight. I think the other thing is, because greenwashing is so prevalent, its presence undermines the claims that are real. So when you're talking about investing, if I have now read articles or I'm aware of the fact that these ESG investment firms aren't all that green, that's going to make me hesitant to invest in any of them, right? Even the legitimate ones. It really undermines the people who are doing the work when you have people out there who are misrepresenting themselves. Generally, creating confusion in the marketplace doesn't help. It doesn't help the consumer and it doesn't help the companies who are actually doing the action properly. It damages the reputation of the green marketplace. The confusion makes everyone a little hesitant to want to put their money there. So I just wanted to highlight that. The other thing is, what we're seeing now is because of greenwashing. And quite honestly, I think another thing we haven't talked about is kind of once you make one claim, you are now kind of, there's a bigger focus on you. Okay. So you may end up having kind of more scrutiny than you would otherwise. And so what we see now is companies and investment portfolios being hesitant to say anything because they don't want to be lumped in with the ones who are greenwashing, and or they recognize maybe not all their investments are green. They've got some, but not all. And they recognize that once you kind of put yourself out there as sustainable, that you're going to get that pressure and people are going to identify kind of where your holes are. So I think that too comes out of greenwashing, and that people are now so hesitant. There's too much confusion is the problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of distrust in the industry. And as a university professor, what role do you play in that process or kind of correcting that wrong? Is that at just the master's level? Is that at PhD level? Is that at a bachelor's level? Or does that go further?
I think it's a great, great question. I mean, I always say when I teach my classes that regardless of whether you're ever going to have a role in marketing, this class is really helpful to you at the very least as a consumer, right? Mm-hmm. So that's not the goal. When I'm teaching a master's student or even an undergrad business major, my goal isn't to just make them a savvy consumer, but you know, what we learn about the marketplace, about things like greenwashing, that does help us as consumers, right? Mm-hmm. That's at a minimum, that's what should be happening. You can talk about education more broadly and the idea of critical thinking and the idea of being able to do your own research. We're in a world right now where that's necessary when it comes to these green messages. Teaching elementary school children, okay, well, that label says that. What does that mean? And how do you know, right? That level of critical thinking it's not a bad idea to make it part of the curriculum, not just for sustainability claims, but any and all claims being made.
What about social media? How does that play into the sustainability message that it's perpetuated?
It's so funny that you say that, because I was just, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking there has been quite a discussion completely unrelated to this, but this idea of fake news, right?
Yeah.
And how do you educate people on recognizing and understanding what is fake news? And so it's the same idea. The information world is a confusing place. And Madeline brought up the word distrust. In some sense, maybe there's not enough distrust. I think there has to be this education around checking your sources. Where does this come from? Understanding that side of things.
It's kind of sad. You know, like, as a sustainability major, you become very cynical. I was a very much of a cynical person before, but you start to question everything. And it can be a little depressing at times watching the news, whether it's about one company doing a horrible greenwashing campaign getting caught, or a news article saying the world is ending and, you know, all this, which is still filled with greenwashed kind of terms or studies, you know, which, Ray, you've seen as a scientist, you get the best of both worlds in biodegradable plastic. And so it's tough to manage, and social media only tends to amplify this or can give power to voices that are misleading or spreading fake news.
You're that interesting combination, Maddie, of bubbly skeptic. You know, you don't usually find those skeptics who have that bubbly personality like you.
That's
do.
True.
That's true. Yeah, a rarity out there. So you mentioned the science part of this. Listening to this conversation has been really eye-opening to me in many ways. To me, one of the most impressive things having this conversation with you, Dr. Townsend, is that you're able to approach sustainability from a different avenue than science. I studied biology. I enjoyed my chemistry and my microbiology studies. I didn't know I was going into sustainability eventually. Here I am doing what I do, but it progressed in a natural way, coming from a science background into a sustainable field. I am fascinated by the idea of someone going into the marketing psychology field and now using that to learn and grow and teach people like Maddie here to be sustainably minded. And what does that actually mean? And how does that affect people on a consumer level? Because I think there are probably lots of people out there who are like, I don't want to put two and two together all the time in math, but I still want to do sustainability. So it's beautiful to see that avenue available now.
Yeah, it's a big problem that can be addressed, or has to be addressed, in multiple manners. And so absolutely, I agree. There's work to be done on all fronts and ways to help, if you will, or educate. That's probably more my job, or create, which is maybe your job, the solutions that we need.
I think they all have to play into each other. You know, you can't create something and then not be able to tell someone about it.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, that's probably one of the biggest problems when it comes to any form of biodegradable plastic. Just saying the term it's a biodegradable plastic has connotations to every single person in an individual way. Mm-hmm. Someone like Maddie and yourself, who's able to take the nuance of what the technology is actually doing, may be able to market in a much more easy, friendly way for consumers to understand and read through.
Yeah.
And this might be a kind of another plug here for the University of Miami, but I think that's one thing that the Masters in Sustainable Business did a really good job of, combining the three schools. You're not just going in or graduating with a degree in one college. I think that translates perfectly into corporate business. We see a lot that when consumers started to demand this, it came a lot from marketing. But then greenwashing became more prevalent and people wanted to see more green accounting. So they started to move more into the accounting field or under finance. So it's touched all aspects of business. A lot of what I do is just cooperating and communicating across multiple departments and pulling together that information and presenting that in a cohesive way. Ray, I think you just touched on that really well.
I think about one of the questions you asked me is, how has this evolved, or how has my teaching of it evolved? And I think one thing I just want to point out at this point, you reminded me, was when this program started and my course started, it was only students who are in the Master's in Sustainable Business. Now my class is 2/3 regular MBAs taking this as an elective. And that's happened pretty quickly. So I think that shows you two things. One is what I said, that this has become a mainstream topic and a mainstream interest, right? That these are people who say, no, even with a regular MBA, this is something I need to know about. So you've got people in the room, the people in the Master's in Sustainable Business. Some of them are people who undergrad did hard science or or even have a master's in hard science. And then you've got someone who wants to go into accounting, but says, this is a course that's relevant to me. So that's something positive.
So Dr. Townsend, as we close out the episode here, we want to do a rapid fire kind of question. I'm going to choose maybe two or three. Who's the most interesting person in the industry right now?
Yeah, Client Earth is a new player in the US, but they've been around in Europe out of England for a while. They're going to be doing a lot of really, really great work in this area. So I think people should be looking out for Client Earth.
Yeah, I've heard of that organization. What surprises you most about the industry in terms of greenwashing?
I think I mentioned this before, but I think I only now started to learn that some of it really is unintentional. It's not all people trying to pull the wool over the consumer's eyes. And that's where education comes in. People just don't know what they're doing.
And then just in a general sense for all of our sustainability listeners out there, if you had to take one degree that, you know, would benefit you in this industry, what would you suggest to people looking to expand their curriculum?
I'm sorry, I've got to go with marketing. It's the part of business that interacts with every other field. So They're the generalists. And if you don't know where you're going to land, marketing is going to help you. Psychology can help, whether it's learning persuasion, how to persuade your boss to take on an initiative, to understanding social cognition. I think that's also a good general skill set to have.
And who do you look to follow in the industry that our listeners can follow as well?
So this year, for whatever reason, I've been doing deep dives into different areas. This year, I've really been doing a deep dive in fashion because it is where there's a lot of greenwashing going on. And The Business of Fashion is a publication that really is starting to talk about sustainability and really identifying what's going on that's right and wrong. So in fashion, that's one way place. I think the Wall Street Journal actually has quite a bit of what's going on, and I appreciate that. The New York Times has a consistent section that I read.
Well, Dr. Townsend, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation and a wonderful launch to this podcast. I was so excited when she told me that our first guest was going to be someone as renowned as yourself, as we heard at the beginning with your background.
I'm so honored. This has been so fun for me, and I can't wait to become a listener and hear your other guests. I think it's a great initiative that you guys are doing, and I look forward to learning from others as well.
Wonderful. If anybody has interest in trying to connect with you and have discussions beyond this, you've let us know that you're willing to accept any and all invitations on LinkedIn to continue the conversation. I also got to thank you for spitting out this one over here, Maddie. She has become a rock star at our company.
She makes me look good. I say, yeah, all my students are that fantastic because she's
just not all of them amazing. Have a podcast. That's all. That's the difference, right?
It's the cultural capital of the podcast that really puts you on the edge.
I couldn't think of a better first guest for our podcast. And on this topic, Professor Townsend, I learned so much in your class, and we'll be sure to link below too. If anyone's interested in applying to the MSSB program at UM, we can link that below.
Thank you guys so much. I can't wait to see what you guys do with this.
We appreciate you. Take care and have a wonderful day. Maddie, oh my God, I feel like I just went through 4 years of university. Is that what it was like for you every day going to school with her?
You know, Ray, it's funny because our master's program was a 2-year program condensed into one. So think about that.
Having Dr. Townsend as our first guest to talk about greenwashing was an absolute godsend. I feel like I'm walking away with a better understanding. I am much more cynical than I already was about all the marketing speech that's going on out there. And I don't think anybody could walk away listening to this podcast without having learned something of importance from marketing and sustainability.
She is definitely a master on the topic.
Listeners, we really appreciate you joining us for episode one. Keep your eyes out on your pod feed for the next episode to drop in the near future. If you have the time, we would appreciate a like and subscribe. Give us that 5-star review that helps us tremendously become popular in this field of ever-growing podcasts. If you want to engage with us and give us some suggestions on topics and individuals you would like us to talk to, please follow us and message us on Instagram at @wearemadefromstone. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a wonderful day. Class is dismissed.